Welcome to the podcast. I'm Dr. Val Jones, founder of GetBetterHealth.com. Today we'll be speaking with Dr. Bob Goldberg about healthcare reform, and Bob is the president of the Center for Medicine in the Public Interest. CMPI Advance is a nonprofit organization focused on educating elected officials, healthcare stakeholders, the general public, and the media about the costs and consequences of greater government control in healthcare and the potential problems that a so-called public plan presents for patients and physicians. CMPI Advance recently launched the Hands Off My Health, found at www.handsoffmyhealth.org, campaign to help emphasize that better health, increased access, and quality should be the foundation of the current national reform debate rather than a public plan option that seeks to control costs by potentially stifling innovation and reducing treatment options for patients and providers. CMPI Advance's sister websites include publicplanfacts.org and biggovhealth.org, both efforts to foster national dialogue on evidence-based analysis of healthcare reform policies under consideration. Joining us on the call today are a group of nurse and physician bloggers. I will introduce them to you now. We have Gina Reibolt, a critical care nurse in the San Francisco Bay Area. She is the author of the popular blog CodeBlog.com. We are joined also by Kim McAllister, who is an emergency medicine nurse in the San Francisco Bay Area as well. She is the author of the popular blog EmergyBlog.com. We have The Happy Hospitalist, who's an anonymous blogger. He is the author of the popular blog Happy Hospitalist, found at thehappyhospitalist.blogspot.com. Dr. Edwin Leap is an emergency medicine physician in Seneca, South Carolina. He is the author of the popular blog edwinleap.com. Dr. Brian Vertebadian is a pediatric gastroenterologist and assistant professor of pediatrics at Baylor College of Medicine, Texas Children's Hospital in Houston, Texas. He is the author of 33charts.com. And we're also joined by Dr. Wes Fisher, a cardiologist and associate professor of medicine at the Feinberg School of Medicine at Northwestern University. And he is the author of the popular blog drwes.com. So these are the folks in the audience, and thank you all for joining the call. It's really great to have you. And to get started, I'd like to ask Dr. Bob Goldberg a few questions. My first question to you, Bob, is proponents of the public plan say that it will dramatically reduce healthcare costs. What is their rationale, and why do you disagree with it?
Well, first of all, thanks for having me on the program today. And the rationale for the public plan is that a government system can go in and do things more efficiently than the private sector because it can cut out the middleman and so on and so forth. The reality is that what public plans usually do is wind up spending a lot more money than actually anticipated. We've already seen that with the first iteration of the proposals in Congress. They're all north of $1 trillion, which everyone was shocked about. They're left just rationing care, rationing access to innovation, new technologies, trying to they cause waiting between diagnosis and treatment and follow-up treatment. All the things that we know are contributory or contributive to higher health care costs. So I don't see the – if you actually sat down and thought it through, you would see that there's no real rationale for a government-run health plan. Many of the health plans that were established in other countries around the world grew out of different political cultures. Ours, you know, for them, they may work fine, although most of them are going broke, frankly. People forget about that fact. And I don't think we should make the same mistake, since people talk about evidence-based medicine. How about evidence-based policy?
Some people say that a new government-run health insurance plan will increase competition among private insurers, extending coverage and enhancing patient choices. How do you respond to that?
Well, you know, this whole idea that the public plan increases choice. People forget that when Barack Obama became president and first came to Washington, the big hoopla in the press was, where would his kids go to school? Now, did he go to the public schools, which unfortunately are substandard in many areas of Washington? No, he had a choice. He went to a private school. And ironically, at the same time that he was doing that, there were members of Congress that were seeking to eliminate funding for vouchers for inner-city kids in D.C. to have the same choice that the President of the United States was. And the point being that competition doesn't come from the public sector. It comes from the private sector. When a public entity gets into the business of producing a good or providing a service, their goal is to crowd out competition or nationalize something. When Hugo Chavez did it in Venezuela, I mean, he wasn't creating a public option for producing oil. He was en route to nationalizing the industry, which he's done. Similarly, as we've seen with the public option here, instead of taking resources and trying to work with doctors and for other providers and health plans to build upon an effort, a value-based effort to improve outcomes, they want to take all this money and start a whole new system from scratch based on the assumption that, if we can corral enough people into these plans cheap enough, we've got them. But everyone knows that at some point the cost of the system of delivering good quality care is going to overwhelm the ability of the taxpayers to provide it. This is something that, you know, we as individuals, you know, ought to be supporting out of our own pockets as well as our premiums and so on. To cede it over to the government would be a tragic mistake. And one final thing, Val, is that we do have an example of, you know, what public options do. Medicare Advantage, you know, is designed to provide those preventive services and disease management programs and everything the president talks about. And, of course, it costs more. He even says it costs more. So what's he doing? He wants to wipe out Medicare Advantage. How's he going to do it? Very easily. He's going to say, we're not paying you the rates that we've been paying you in the past. You're going to take a haircut. And you know what? You have no choice. If you don't like it, go away. We'll just, you know, Medicare will be surviving as it always was. And that's the same thing that's going to happen with a public plan. They'll come in, they'll undercut the margin because the market because they can, because it's the government. And then once the other companies who have been investing in prevention and have been showing losses, you know, go out of business, there's nothing left.
So what do you think the impact of a public plan will be on patients?
Well, let's talk about not just patients, but about the doctor-patient relationship. I think that's very important. And something, of course, I'd love to hear from the people who are listening today. I just know that in Massachusetts or in Medicaid or in SCHIP, that if you look at the literature, you see systematically people are being seen by the doctors when they are the most sick. There are longer waiting times. That when you look at infant mortality rates among Medicaid managed care populations, because of the payment rates, the mortality rates are not decreasing. They're not using the same kinds of techniques and technologies that are available elsewhere in many cases because they're prohibited from doing so. You yourself gave a great example of in the rehab setting where, you know, if you're a patient that doesn't fit within 13 requirements of what it means to be in need of rehab, you're out. Otherwise, you know, your institution's under investigation. So that kind of cost-driven, trying to save money to expand the public plan is going to permeate the mindset and action of every doctor as they go into the examination room with their patient. And we've already had that with managed care. It's going to be twice as bad with a public-run plan.
And what do you think about the impact on physicians and nurses in terms of reimbursement and their everyday lives?
Well, in the current legislation, they already know what they're going to do, and that is they're going to pay you less. There's a lot of talk about spending more money on graduate education, on education for nurses, and so on and so forth, and that's terrific. All well and good, but if the goal is to make this thing run by paying Medicaid rates and in certain portions of the Kennedy bill, at least, that's what they were going to pay doctors, primary care doctors, to do prevention, the Medicaid rates, and no higher, we're going to have a real problem. I spoke to a group of residents a few weeks ago, and a lot of them were leaving, not even thinking of primary care or pediatric care after the residency because they realized that they weren't, given the amount of money they had spent on their medical school or the nursing school education, it wasn't the place to go. And they were concerned that Medicaid and government reimbursement was going to make it that much more difficult to practice medicine. And frankly, you know, President Obama in his town hall meeting, which got beat up by CSI, by the way, it goes to show you that people, you know, are, I think, already getting turned off to all the rhetoric. They don't believe it. They, you know, he says, oh, yeah, we're going to pay doctors more. But everything that's going on in the bill, this is not, again, this is the point, this is not about, health care reform is not about health. It's about finding money to create a public plan. And we've got to change the terms of the debate to ensure that the focus is on investing in systems and information technology and reimbursement mechanisms that encourage people to invest in long-term health and continuity of care, which, you're right, at the upfront it may be expensive, but that's the infrastructure we want for a healthier American population.
Now, some argue that the public plan would not actually be a gateway for broader government control over health care in the future. Do you think that that argument is sound?
Is there any government program that got smaller that you know of? Vaccine for children is a great example. I mean, they were supposed to go away when SCHIP, when the Children's Health Insurance Program came into being. We still have bureaucrats deciding to a large extent, you know, what states should get what vaccines at what time. And that was almost 15 years ago. Similarly, the same proponents who claim that were also the ones who were pushing for massive expansions of Medicaid, kids' health care, and Medicare as vehicles for insuring uninsured Americans. And here's the final point, Dr. Val. Every one of the bills on Capitol Hill estimates that up to 100 million Americans should be shuffled into the health plans because employers, when faced with a 50% tax on wages, you know, as the entry fee for participating in these exchanges, are going to say, you know what, we'll just pay the fine. It's cheaper. It's cheaper for us. And that's the way the fine has been. That's the way it's structured. So let me be blunt. There's a lot of lying going on right now to push this public plan. I think a lot of people are seeing right through it, and that's why a lot of people switched to CSI during the town hall meeting with the president.
Well, some very provocative initial comments from Dr. Bob Goldberg. Now we're going to turn to questions from our audience, and we will begin with a question from Dr. Edwin Leap. Dr. Edwin Leap, do you have a question for Dr. Goldberg?
I do. Thank you, Dr. Goldberg. That's
thank you.
What most of the folks in my practice who are really seeing patients feel exactly the same way. I work in the emergency department, and we have, you know, labored under a federal mandate since EMTALA was created. And I wonder if anyone's looked at the parallels there. It's not exact. No analogy is perfect. But we have a situation where we have to see everyone regardless of ability to pay. And what it has created, it has created some access, there's no question, and it has done a few good things. But in the end, the unintended consequences have been departments have shut down, hospitals have closed, access to specialists is less because people are taking themselves off call, like neurosurgeons, et cetera, because they know they won't get reimbursed. And the sense of entitlement has grown enormously. So people come in and they demand, you know, the immediate care for the most minor thing because they know that they don't have to pay. So it has removed all personal responsibility and has really harmed reimbursement for physicians. Emergency physicians in small towns, there just aren't any. In rural areas, they're struggling. You know, we're collecting about 25% of what we bill because of them.
Wow.
Really, that's true. And yet our volume is climbing.
Yeah, I guess my response would be, you know, get ready for more of the same.
Right.
And with respect to the emergency room, again, you know, the president made a big deal about, oh, you know, we've got to get people away from the ER. I think that the fact of the matter is, you know, if you look at the numbers, people with insurance are the problem because they just find the emergency room to be a highly convenient place to get to show up.
Sure.
So, but unfortunately, what's happened as well is that because of the emergency Medicaid rules, if you show up to say I'm uninsured, you've got to be insured enrolled on the spot in Medicaid, and you have to be treated, and that's how many illegal immigrants have been receiving assistance. And in the state of New York, for example, you can now, in addition to getting obstetrical and pediatric care through the emergency program as an illegal immigrant, you can get chemotherapy, liposuction. I mean, I am not kidding.
That's incredible.
So it is a huge problem. I'd like to have a separate conversation with the ER guys, because I think that issue of people showing up is not going to go away, and let the people that run the show there come up with a business model that makes sense to them and to their customers. But that's not going to happen with government, I'm afraid. I think they're just going to say, we're going to get people the money, we'll get them insurance, we'll deal with this ER thing, when it gets in the news again.
Right.
So, excellent point. Thank you.
Thank you, sir.
Thank you. And let's turn to Kim McAllister, who is an emergency medicine nurse. Kim, do you have a question for Dr. Goldberg?
I do. Yesterday, I was trying to catch up on what Obama was saying, because I actually missed the town hall thing last night. So I was looking up what he had said on Good Morning America in an interview with Diane Sawyer, and something caught me by surprise. He was talking about best practices and putting a commission together made up of doctors that would define what best practices is. And then after that, then best practices would then be practiced by all the physicians based on those guidelines. And Diane Sawyer said, by law. In other words, what are you going to do if they don't do it? Are they going to be forced by law to do these best practices? And he breezed right over that sentence. I couldn't believe she asked it, because it was a pretty tough thing to ask.
Yeah.
He breezed right over it, never acknowledged it. He then said, well, people trust their doctors, and if their doctors are saying this is the best way to practice, we think that will help patients, and their doctors communicate, because they'll trust their doctors. But he totally bypassed the, is this going to be enforceable by law, and what's going to happen to the doctors who don't agree with those best practices?
Well, that's another good question. And first of all, it's not a panel of doctors who are deciding it. It's a bunch of bureaucrats who will decide what studies are done and how they're doing. I'm on their mailing list, and they're doing one evaluation to see whether it's actually worth screening people for general screening for hypothyroid for thyroid conditions. So they're going to come up with a one-size. What they're going to do is look at all the guidelines, from the endocrinology community and other people, and look at all the randomized clinical trials and say, and these are people who don't practice medicine, to say, we shouldn't be doing screening for this population or that population, and that will become, even if it's not law, sort of a hard and fast rule for reimbursement guidelines. And they're going to try to do it in this sort of cookbook fashion for every type of condition. And my concern is that there's a significant amount of new evidence that we can collect on people's individual responses to treatments based upon, what folks are doing in the trenches. And we are not using our health IT, we're not using the dollars for this commission to figure out, what's best for each particular patient, and spreading the tools to learn from those experiences to the provider community.
And my concern was what happens when a doctor says, what best practices says, I don't agree with this. I want you to have this, are there going to be legal sanctions against these physicians? Because she did say by law, would this be a law that you must follow these guidelines? What happens to the doctor who says, no, these guidelines don't fit here? Are there going to be, would there be sanctions?
Good question. Well, you know, there's a piece of legislation that the administration supports sitting in Congress today that would give the Medicare Payment Commission, you know, absolute authority to set reimbursement rates for all different things and, you know, get Congress out of the business, which means that, you know, if you're providing care for a Medicare patient and you go outside, you know, you do an MRI when they don't think you should, if you put a stent in when they don't think you should, so on and so forth, yeah, you could be liable. It's you know, if you do it enough times, and you try to submit the bills and or try to recode it or something, they could just say, you know, you're not going to be a provider anymore, or we're going to. I mean, I think it's an extreme case, but really, what does happen is that doctors start practicing defensively, and they don't have the same tools that they'll have available because those decisions have already been made for them by the entities that they work for, and that's probably the bigger danger. That so much of what is in the pipeline or could be in the pipeline won't be available because we're going to have to undergo this evidence review instead of allowing people to sort of learn by using and other kinds of information. I think that's the real threat.
Dr. Brian Vardabedian, do you have a question for Dr. Goldberg?
Yeah, Bob, that was interesting. I had a question perhaps you could offer some insight on. That is, are there any real numbers on how many uninsured people there are in the United States? I've heard some mixed feedback on how the quota numbers represent people who choose not to get insurance, illegal Americans and whatnot. Can you go over that?
Yeah, actually, you know, I have an article on the ABC News Health website on this because I wanted to make the point that everybody is uninsured in the same way. There are 12 million, according to the Census Bureau, 12 million people in the United States who are here illegally that are counted in the 47 million. There are up to 7 million people. There are about 9 million people who are eligible for Medicaid or the Kids Health Program that are not enrolled. There are another 7 million people who are offered health care in the workplace and don't take it. And there's 5 million in that there's a subgroup there who are young and are single and make $70,000 a year or more. And, you know, if you want just a basic coverage plan, it's not that expensive. For an individual getting that coverage who's relatively healthy, it's not a big lift. So the question becomes, why are we going to spend $2 trillion to insure people when we could probably do it for a lot cheaper by offering a whole different range of healthcare products that probably meet their needs and lifestyles and in a much more affordable fashion? I mean, that's just the beginning. We're not even talking about giving rebates or whatever for wellness kinds of initiatives.
That's so great. Thanks.
Yeah.
Okay, to Dr. Wes Fisher. Dr. Fisher, do you have a question for Dr. Goldberg?
Well, I think there's a couple things that we've already seen some telltale signs of what might happen with this. I guess the first question was, if the government's so good at taking care of health care and doing such a great job with government-run programs, why are we about to go fiscally unsound with Medicare, which is a government-run entitlement program? That would be one question. If we think that anything larger and even more expensive is going to fix the problem. So given that Medicare is a relatively insulated and well-defined population of people, and that we could deploy our healthcare information systems to the current population of patients that are already there, and if they could indeed use that first group to show improvement and cost savings to healthcare delivery in that group, why not start there? Why are we investing $1.2 trillion, which magically dissipated from $1.6 trillion in the span of a week? Why are we spending this kind of money when we already have government programs in place that they can't seem to get a handle on? And so we should probably fix Medicare first if we're going to try and prove that the government can save money in health care. Now, I don't think there's any question in my mind that some type of rationing has to occur. Whether or not the government is the best people to do that is the other question. And I would argue that the doctor-patient relationship still may be the best place to do that. But I think that, you know, there are skewed incentive programs, and the way doctors are paid is a challenging and very difficult option. I sat down and looked at my hourly wage and noted that when I calculate my call, I'm on 17 weeks of the year, and I may not be in the hospital, but my pager's on and I'm available for over 2,800 hours a year. And my salary was, when I calculated it based on everything, it was about, I don't know, $140 an hour. Now, relate that to a lawyer and what they're getting paid.
Yeah.
The fact that we're going to do this without any type of tort reform or major malpractice reform, we're ordering tests, okay, and driving costs up because we're practicing defensive medicine. And President Obama does not appear to be interested in addressing that issue whatsoever because of his constituency that out-donated to him 4-to-1 compared to physicians in the current campaign. So we've got a lot of work to do from many different angles, but I guess the question would be, why not fix Medicare first?
That's a great question, and you know we. Well, I mean, you should write an article around everything you said. That's a great question. It's a great challenge. Again, the president sort of glides over and says, "Well, we need health care reform because Medicare is going broke," and the two are separate. And not only that, they're an example of how not to do things.
Haven't been a government employee for 13 and a half years as an active duty Navy physician, and knowing that when I was in the cath lab, we had a $1.2 million budget, and defibrillators came on board, and all of a sudden they were $30,000 a pop, and we knew that these things saved lives, and we started putting them in people, and guess what? We blew our budget out of the water completely.
Yeah.
And what did the government do? Well, they rationed the number we could put in. And we had to deal with that. It's pretty tough to take an active duty kid who's, you know, found out that he has a cardiomyopathy and tell him, "I'm sorry, you can't get a defibrillator because Uncle Sam says we don't have the money." And the reality is we're going to have to be doing that. And the question is who do we do it to? Now, the military had a unique way. They had rank, and they had active duty, dependent status, and retirees. So we could ration that way so that the active duty came first, their dependents came second, and the retirees came third. And I would be venturing to bet that a government plan will be doing exactly the same thing.
Well, they do it in other countries. And, of course, but the point is that cost is still exploding. So because, you know, I guess my argument is that you take Medicare, for example, you can pretty much we pinpointed through we were on a panel yesterday with the National Minority Quality Forum, and they pretty much pinpointed the over the last 5 years, the people that are going to be the biggest contributors to the cost of Medicare each and every year. Is a very small percentage of people with congestive heart failure, chronic kidney disease, and diabetes contribute from certain areas of the country every year, you know, contributing about 68% of the cost. And exactly what you said, you know, why don't we do sort of a surge against chronic illness, target the resources, and do what you have to do to stop the progression before it hits and structure the payment that way. It's impossible, like, for the government to change on a dime. It's a lot easier for smaller, you know, entities, particularly those in the private sector, to do so. And I think, you know, when it comes to the rationing kind of thing, I think that's really a decision people should make with their doctors based upon what they want to pay and their quality of life and so on. And there again, I mean, it's it's really up to everybody to sort of generate the better evidence and convey it in a way that's usable for the individual. I know that my uncle, he had a bypass surgery when he was 85, and then he was doing great and living at 92, and then he had an aneurysm. And he asked the doctors what the chances of success were, and he said, you know, I just don't want to go through it. And that was that. So I think everything you said was really spot on, and it shows you just how ass backwards. And you have to delete that out, balance there. But the entire system is, and let's fix that first. Absolutely right, 100%. Or let the politicians join the public plans that they create and give up. If they're so good and so effective, then let them join the plans themselves.
Well, that definitely will not happen. And I think that, a lot of this, there's a lot of spin, and that's what Washington does very well. But there's very few people who are on the ground having to talk these decisions with patients. And when we're one-on-one with a patient and we're looking at life and death situations, what's really striking to me is that all of the policy issues really are immaterial. We're going to do what we have to do in order to help save someone's life or preserve at least some sanity. Now, there may be rules, but those rules are going to have to be dictated, and we're going to have to be protected. And if we don't have any backing against liability reform, you know, some way to prevent us from becoming liable if we don't do something, I think it's all just a bunch of smoke and mirrors.
Yeah, well, I agree. And the whole show up there, it is smoke and mirrors, is to divert attention from the fact that the game is to find as much money as they can to create a public plan and not to invest in things that would make the practice of medicine the kind of pursuit that I think everyone on the line would agree should be the ultimate it should be the ultimate fusion of humanity and scientific discovery.
Okay, we're going to go to Gina Reibold. Gina, do you have a question for Dr. Goldberg?
I do. Something very near and dear to my heart. I work in critical care, and it is a rare thing that I go into work and I'm not taking care of a 90-year-old, demented, nonverbal, contracted person on 3 pressors. The family says, go, 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 do everything you possibly can. And the doctors are like, no, it's not going to help. You know, the result will be the same. Yet we have to do what the family says pretty much every time. I'd love to know what futile care, how that fits into healthcare reform, if there's any real numbers on how futile care, how prominent it is, how much money is spent on it.
Mm-hmm.
Love to know what you think about that.
Well, most money in healthcare spent in the last 2 years of life, well, that's because in the last 2 years of life, that's when we're most chronically ill. Address chronic illness, and what you find out is that people that are old, who have fewer disabilities, don't cost a lot to care for. It's the chronic illnesses and all the complications that come with it. And that number, actually, that amount has been pretty much fixed for the last 20 years. And the percentage that of Medicare dollars that it claims has been fixed as well, and frankly, it's not all that much. It's about 6 to 10% of the Medicare budget, which was not just loose change, but it's not exactly the kind of thing you can use to keep Medicare from going broke or fund a single payer health system. Again, I think I know a lot of conversations. I know there's a friend of mine who is now focusing on hospice care, independence at home kinds of living arrangements, and at some point I will have to deal with things like that. I hope I don't. I don't know what the answer is, except to say that if you want to apply a hard and fast rule on withholding care at the end of life, do you then apply the same kinds of hard and fast rules at the beginning of life when you have low birth weight babies who are struggling to survive. And that raises an ethical question that I think, frankly, government should stay the hell out of. That's my opinion. You know, let's figure out what works and what people can do, and try to deal with that. But government cannot be involved in that. At least, in my opinion, be involved in that decision. Then you're one step away from being a monster, I think. And they're already doing those kinds of things in some other countries. When the UK debated about whether to extend ICU services to low birth weight babies of below 500 grams, you know what their discussion was? Well, you know, yeah, some of these babies will make it, which is great, but then they're going to have all these disabilities, and they're going to be so expensive for society, a burden to society. And, I just don't want... I don't want to live in a world where we're beginning to value the worth of our fellow beings because they have disabilities compared to us. Or it takes them a lot longer to learn English at an eighth grade level. I mean, it took me until I was 30. So you got to give people a break here.
Well, with respect, it's completely different. I mean, people living with disabilities are completely different from people who are nonverbal and have absolutely zero chance of life. I mean, you can have three doctors agree that this patient is absolutely not going to make it. The only reason that we're spending $20,000 a day on them is because the family can't let go. I mean, that's completely different from low birth weight babies.
Well, this would be a great. I don't want to take up too much time on it, but I guess my point is that these are really difficult decisions. I think it's up to us to come up with answers, results that are going to ease the pain, allow letting go, that will save everybody time and effort and resources. Of course, it's easy for me to say. I'm not in that situation, but you're hitting on something that, as we live a longer life, we're going to have to face that challenge. But beginning of the spectrum, we are doing more and more to keep low birth weight babies at lower and lower weights, at lower periods of gestation alive as well. And that's just a function of the science that we have. And I think, as the doctor said, those are the kinds of choices as individuals we're going to have to make. But it's, again, I'm not a bioethicist. I didn't go to school for it. I'm just a policy guy. I'm really just telling you how I feel, and I understand from your perspective. And again, my uncle made the choice himself when given the alternatives of just saying he'd just rather spend his days quietly in hospice than having all these things done to him.
Yeah. Okay, and we have a question from the Happy Hospitalist.
Oh, hi. Okay.
Hi, all. Nice discussion. I appreciate the opportunity to listen. Just got a couple comments here. I remember reading a year or so ago that about 5% of our population spends about half of all healthcare dollars. And we already know that chronic illness is so expensive. And it's expensive, I think, whether you're being taken care of in the public sector or in the private sector. I've blogged pretty extensively in the past as a physician how I can, in the current model of both public and private healthcare insurance, essentially, the only requirement to get anything paid for is to have a medical necessity. It doesn't matter whether you're under Medicare or Blue Cross or any other insurance plan. I could pretty much make anything medically necessary if I put the right words in the right place and be completely honest about it. I could create medical necessity out of thin air and not even have to lie about it. So I guess the question I have, under the current system that we operate under, both public and private, I don't see either one of them as sustainable in the long term. We already know Medicare is essentially bankrupt, and most private insurance plans are becoming so expensive that most businesses can't even afford them. So it doesn't matter whether you're under public or private, you're offering public or private insurance. I look at it as a problem. Should we be not focusing on public versus private as opposed to making an argument for healthcare reform under changing the whole framework of how it's being paid, chronic illness in specifically. I mean, it doesn't matter. I look at this, and I'm not a big fan of government. I'm not a big fan of the private sector either. I just think that the systems in place for both are so skewed and so
right,
and so the incentives are in all the wrong places that it won't matter whether you have 100% private and 0% government or 100% government and 0% private. They're both doomed for failure. And I'm just wondering, have you given any thought to taking the argument to a different level, not public versus private, but rather how do you pay for chronic illness in general?
Well, as a matter of fact, I mean, that is what we're trying to do, is we're trying to say that the debate should not be about just how much money to save for a public plan, but exactly what you said. Let's take the resources, acknowledging that there's a problem that both, and I think people forget that almost 10 years ago, there was this huge backlash against managed care for doing exactly what people are proposing in the public plan. And they had to loosen up to a large degree. That the entire system is not in sync with what we know about chronic disease, how we can treat it, how we can prevent it. It's not a platform for emerging health information technologies or for new medicines. And together we have to change the system. That's a far different, and you know what the mix of public and private is in that enterprise, frankly, I don't know. And I don't care. I like you, I want a better system. I happen to, you know, my own bias is that probably, you know, the private sector probably can deliver this turnaround more efficiently than the government can, but not without it, of course, particularly since we got Medicaid and Medicare in there. But that's exactly right. That's what the debate should be. How do we turn the ship around now that we've had this national conversation, and we should give the president a lot of credit for that, about, you know, what we value and what we want out of our healthcare system? And it would really be a shame. Should I call you Dr. Hospitalist or Dr. Happy?
Dr. Happy's fine.
Dr. Happy, that you know, if we lost the ability, you know, the opportunity to do that. Now there are some good proposals out there that address the concerns that you raised and I share. And the Bipartisan Policy Center put together what I thought was a pretty darn good piece of legislation that is focused on improving health and building that infrastructure, as opposed to deciding, you know, what is public and what is private. You put the money out there, you get people engaged, you see what works, you evaluate it, you move on if it doesn't work. At the same time, you give individuals, particularly those who are chronically ill, you know, risk-adjusted coverage, and let people go at it. But the other thing is that this is going to be a 20-year effort, more. And it would be a shame if we wasted all those resources to set up a system of payment and reimbursement that wasn't focused on these particular issues, but was really focused on trying to squeeze every last dime out of the taxpayer or the physician to make budget.
You've been listening to a podcast interview with Dr. Bob Goldberg, president of the Center for Medicine in the Public Interest Advance, about healthcare reform. To learn more, please check out CMPI's website at www.handsoffmyhealth.org. I'm Dr. Val Jones, founder of GetBetterHealth.com.